Becatra podcast conversations for the curious essential knowledge simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Becatra AI. Welcome back, everyone, to the deep dive. Today, we are getting into a book that, well, it really surprises people when they first encounter it in relation to its author. We're diving into Adam Smith's The Theory of Moral Sentiments.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? You hear Adam Smith and immediately your mind jumps to economics, right?
Yeah.
The Wealth of Nations, the invisible hand, supply and demand.
Exactly. And that's kind of the point. Most people know him as the, you know, the father of modern economics.
But this book, The Theory of Moral Sentiments, it came out way earlier, 1759. So a full 17 years before Wealth of Nations. And honestly, you could argue it's the real foundation. It's the ethical bedrock.
It really is. It's where he tackles this fundamental question. Okay, if we're all, let's say, primarily self-interested, how on earth do we end up with morality? How do societies develop these shared ethical codes?
And his big idea, which was pretty radical then, wasn't about like divine rules or pure logic. He said morality grows out of something innate in us, our capacity for sympathy, that feeling with others.
So this deep dive is really about giving you a shortcut to understanding that foundational theory, the ethical side of Adam Smith.
Maybe we should quickly sketch out who Smith was beyond the economics tag. Adam Smith, 1723 to 1790, Scottish philosopher, huge figure in the Scottish Enlightenment.
Right. Educated at Glasgow, then Oxford, very much a product of that philosophical tradition.
And I think the key thing to grasp is his day job. For a long time anyway, he was the professor of moral philosophy at the University of Glasgow.
Yeah, that's crucial. His main focus wasn't market forces initially. It was ethics, virtue, what makes a good person, what makes a just society tick.
What makes his approach still feel so relevant, I think, is that he wasn't just an armchair theorist. He combined that philosophical rigor with really sharp observation. He watched how people actually behaved.
Almost like an early social psychologist, you know, studying how we react to each other, why we want approval.
Exactly. And that's why moral sentiments is such a vital corrective to the sort of cartoon version of Smith as just championing greed. He was deeply concerned with the moral framework within which self-interest operates.
It's about the conditions needed for a decent society, not just a rich one.
Okay, so let's get into the book itself. The Theory of Moral Sentiments. It's a really ambitious exploration, trying to trace morality right from our basic emotional responses.
It starts, as you said, with observing others. We see someone happy or sad, and it triggers this imaginative leap he calls sympathy.
And we need to be clear on his definition here. Sympathy for Smith isn't just pity. It's the ability to sort of project yourself into someone else's situation and feel a version of what they're feeling.
A fellow feeling.
Precisely. And from that basic sympathetic reaction, we start making judgments. First, we judge the propriety of their feelings, like is their emotional reaction fitting for the situation?
Okay, right. Like if someone's ecstatic over finding a penny versus finding a lost pet, the reaction should match the cause.
Exactly. And then second, we judge the merit or demerit of the actions that result from those feelings. Do those actions deserve praise, blame, reward, punishment?
And then comes the really ingenious part, doesn't it? This whole process of judging others and knowing we're being judged. It gets internalized.
Mm-hmm. That's the leap. All that social feedback gradually builds what Smith calls the impartial spectator. It's like an inner referee, an unbiased judge sitting inside us.
Our conscience, essentially.
Basically, yes. A well-developed conscience formed through social experience.
So his big claim is that morality isn't imposed from outside. It emerges naturally from our psychology, from our need for connection and approval. It's grounded in how we actually are.
Let's dive a bit deeper into part I then, which is all about sympathy and propriety. As we said, sympathy is that imaginative act.
Putting yourself in their shoes.
Right. And propriety is about whether we can sympathize with the motive driving someone's feeling or action. Can we go along with their emotional state?
So if someone bursts into tears because they stubbed their toe, maybe we struggle to sympathize fully with the intensity of that emotion. We might see it as lacking propriety.
Yeah, it seems disproportionate. But if they burst into tears because they just lost a loved one, our sympathy flows easily. The emotion feels entirely proper to the situation. The motive, the cause, justifies the feeling.
And Smith points out this really deep human need we have for mutual sympathy.
Oh, absolutely. It feels good when others understand our feelings when they get us, and it feels bad when they don't.
So we're constantly, maybe unconsciously, adjusting our emotional displays to try and achieve that resonance with others. It kind of keeps society in tune.
Exactly. It's the glue. Now, moving to part two, merit and demerit. This is where we judge the action itself. Is it good or bad, praiseworthy or blameworthy?
And he introduces this idea of compound sympathy, which sounds a bit technical, maybe.
It can seem that way, but it's actually quite intuitive when you break it down. Mm-hmm. To judge an action, Smith says we perform two acts of sympathy.
Okay.
First, we sympathize with the actor's motive. Was their intention proper? That's part one. And second, we sympathize with the recipient's reaction, usually their gratitude if the action was good, or their resentment if it was harmful.
Ah, I see. So if you help someone, I sympathize with your kind motive and I sympathize with their thankfulness. Both align, so I approve of the action's merit.
Precisely. But if you lash out unfairly, I might not sympathize with your motive, improper anger, and I strongly sympathize with the victim's resentment. So the action has demerit.
That makes sense. And this is where he draws that really crucial line between justice and beneficence, right?
Yes, absolutely critical. Justice, for Smith, is basically not harming others, respecting their rights, their property, their person. It's a negative virtue. Don't do bad things.
And it's essential, the bare minimum. Society can't exist without it. It's like the foundation walls of a house.
Exactly. And it's enforceable. We can have laws against theft, assault, etc. But beneficence? That's actively doing good. Kindness, charity, generosity.
That's the positive stuff. Highly praiseworthy, makes society better, more beautiful. But you can't force people to be kind.
Right. It's like the decorations on the house. Essential. No. Desirable. Absolutely. But you can't legislate it. This distinction is key for figuring out what government should and shouldn't do.
Okay. So that leads perfectly into part three and the impartial spectator. Because if morality is all about social approval, aren't we just puppets of public opinion?
That's the obvious challenge, isn't it? How do we develop genuine inner conviction? Smith's answer is the impartial spectator. We essentially split ourselves in two.
There's the me who acts, the agent, and the me who watches and judges, the spectator.
Exactly. But the spectator isn't just echoing the crowd outside. It's an impartial spectator. It's the voice of reason, fairness, objectivity, internalized. It's what a well-informed, unbiased observer would think of our conduct.
So it's our conscience, but refined. It's learned through experience, but aims for objectivity. It allows us to judge ourselves even when no one else is watching.
Mm-hmm. And this leads to the concept of self-command, learning to moderate our passions, our immediate reactions, to align our conduct with what the impartial spectator would approve of.
And the highest moral achievement, then, isn't just getting praised by others.
No, it's being praiseworthy. It's acting in a way that your own internalized, impartial spectator genuinely approves of, regardless of external applause. That's true virtue.
Okay, so morality is grounded in sympathy and the impartial spectator. Where does cold, hard usefulness, utility fit into all this? That's part four, right?
Yeah, utility and ambition. This myth says, look, we don't primarily approve of things because they're useful. We approve because the motive feels right, because we sympathize. Utility is often a secondary effect, an afterthought.
But he does acknowledge that people chase things like wealth, and often not just for comfort, but for the admiration it brings. It connects back to that desire for mutual sympathy, almost.
It does. And this leads him to that famous little story, the parable of the poor man's son.
Ah, yes. The guy who dedicates his entire life to getting rich and powerful, sacrificing everything.
Right. Chasing status, thinking it will bring ultimate happiness and admiration. Smith calls it deception. He thinks the poor man's son is often chasing an illusion that the wealthy aren't necessarily happier.
But here's the twist.
Here's the twist. While the individual might be chasing a kind of illusion, their relentless, self-interested drive, building businesses, innovating, employing people, unintentionally benefits everyone.
And that's where the invisible hand comes in this book, too.
Exactly. He says the rich are led by an invisible hand to make nearly the same distribution of the necessaries of life, which would have been made had the earth been divided into equal portions. They pursue their own vanity, but end up advancing the public good. It connects the moral desire for status to economic progress.
Fascinating how it links the two books. Okay, and finally, part six pulls it all together into the character of virtue. What are the key traits?
He sums it up with four main virtues, guided by that impartial spectator. First, prudence, taking proper care of your own health, finances, reputation, sensible self-interest.
Then justice. We covered that. Don't harm others. Absolutely fundamental. The pillar.
Third, beneficence. Actively doing good for others. The noble ornamental virtue.
And fourth, tying it all together.
Self-command. The ability to control your passions, to act according to prudence, justice, and beneficence, even when it's difficult or unpopular. That's the mastery virtue.
Okay, let's step back. What are the really big takeaways from moral sentiments that still resonate powerfully today?
I think theme one has to be, morality is fundamentally emotional. Ethics isn't just abstract rules. It starts with our gut feelings, our ability to resonate with others, sympathy.
Which means maybe we need to actively practice putting ourselves in others' shoes, especially when things get morally tricky. It's a skill to cultivate.
Definitely. Theme two, conscience isn't born, it's built. The impartial spectator develops through social interaction and reflection.
That feels empowering, actually. It means we're not stuck with our initial biases. We can consciously work on our moral compass by, say, listening to different perspectives.
Absolutely. Theme three, justice sets the boundary for freedom. That clear line Smith draws between justice, must do, enforceable, and beneficence, nice to do, voluntary, is vital for thinking about liberty.
Right. It argues for a limited role for compulsion. The state enforces the basic rules of not harming each other, but it shouldn't try to force kindness or enforce specific outcomes beyond that. Still very relevant for debates about law versus social pressure today.
Mm-hmm. And maybe theme four, self-interest needs morality to work.
Hmm.
Smith showed that even economic life depends on trust, fairness, and that desire to be seen as decent, the things governed by the impartial spectator. Pure greed is unstable.
Society needs that ethical framework to channel ambition productively.
And Smith just has such a way with words. Some lines really capture the essence.
Like the very opening line of the whole book. It throws down the gauntlet immediately. How selfish soever man may be supposed, there are evidently some principles in his nature which interest him in the fortune of others.
Bam. Right there. He's saying, okay, yeah, we can be selfish, but there's also this fundamental capacity for caring about others.
Mm-hmm.
Sympathy is real. It's built in. It sets the stage for everything else.
And then the core mechanism of self-judgment. We endeavor to examine our own conduct as we imagine any other fair and impartial spectator would examine it.
That's the whole theory in a nutshell, isn't it? Internalizing that objective viewpoint to guide ourselves.
And politically, that warning about the man of system.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
The planner who sees people as just pieces upon a chessboard, forgetting that every single piece has a principle of motion of its own.
Such a powerful critique of top-down control, of treating people like objects in some grand design, ignoring the individual lives and motivations. It's a timeless warning against arrogance and power.
Totally. And finally, just hammering home the basics. Justice is the main pillar that upholds the whole edifice.
No ambiguity there. Take away benevolence, society is less nice. Take away justice, society falls apart.
So how can we actually use these ideas day to day?
Well, application one seems to be about personal decisions. When you're facing something tricky, actually pause and ask, okay, step back. What would a fair, informed observer think of my motives and actions here? It's a practical way to try and access that impartial spectator and get some perspective beyond your own immediate feelings or biases.
Yeah, it forces a bit of self-honesty. Application two could be in resolving conflicts.
Hmm.
Instead of just arguing about who's right or wrong about the facts, maybe focus first on achieving that mutual sympathy. Try to genuinely understand why the other person feels the way they do.
Like, okay, I hear that you feel X because of Y, is that right? Even if you disagree with their conclusion, validating their feeling can unlock things, build some trust.
Definitely. And application three, maybe for leadership, whether in business or anywhere else, don't be the man of system imposing rigid plans.
Right. Instead, try to create an environment of fairness. Act like an impartial spectator yourself when dealing with people and appeal to their desire to be praiseworthy, not just compliant. Give them space to act ethically.
Trust them to have that principle of motion of their own.
Hmm. You know, reflecting on this, what really strikes me is how Smith saw human nature as a whole. We tend to separate the economic person from the moral person, but for him, they were deeply intertwined. That drive for status, for approval, it fuels both our economic activity and our moral development.
Yeah, that's a great point. It's a much more integrated view of humanity.
Hmm.
And ultimately, I find it a very humane and, dare I say, optimistic theory. Morality isn't some external burden we have to carry.
It grows out of who we are.
Exactly. It emerges from our fundamental need for connection, our capacity for sympathy. By grounding ethics in our actual psychology, Smith shows a path where being good is natural, and it leads to both personal well-being and a functional society. It feels achievable.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.